Was that a debate or a coup d'etat? We'll talk about that this week on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. And this is our show for 6/29. That's June 29th, 2024. I'm recording this on June 28th, 2024. I had seriously considered recording earlier than today, and we're recording something entirely different, but I remembered that the first presidential debate, and I will make a prediction that this will be the last presidential debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And anyone who knows anything about what happened last night on Thursday, the 27th, will understand what I'm talking about. I don't think that the Biden camp will allow another debacle like we just witnessed. What could happen? Well, we'll get into that. What happened last night? We became a different country last night. Now, what do I mean by that? What really changed? We became a country before the debate. We were under the impression that, at least some of us were under the impression, that we had a president who was competent and able to do the things that a president of the United States has to do. That he was capable of making decisions regarding the use of military force, the use of our atomic arsenal, our nuclear arsenal, all those things that a president must do, making the proper choices as regards foreign policy, as regards defense policy, as regards trade policy, as regards immigration policy. We thought we had a number of people thought that I personally have thought that the president of the United States, Joe Biden, is non compos mentis, and has been was essentially propped up, and his administration was run by his puppet masters, there's precedent for that, by the way. It's not a good precedent, but there is precedent for that. And I have thought all along that he should not have been in the office. Now, does that necessarily mean, I've known people, my own mother was this way, who thought we were going to prove that the election was stolen in 2020 and that Trump would be in office. And I'm like, Mom, that's not the way this works. we have an electoral process. We have a system wherein, in the vote for president, the states certify their ballots for electors, and they send them to Washington, D.C., and the votes are opened and counted, and the elections are all certified. Once the election's certified, the election process is over. There is a presidential candidate, unless there's a tie voting in the Electoral College, which is entirely possible. It can happen, and it has happened in the past more than once. But we have this process, and once that happens, we have someone who's been elected president of the United States. We've never had a president who's been made unable to fulfill the office before inauguration. We have had one president who, during his inauguration speech, stood in the freezing rain with his hat off while he made a speech. William Henry Harrison, and he caught a cold, which turned into bronchitis, which turned into pneumonia, and 31 days after taking the oath of office, he died. So we have a president in our history who died 31 days after taking the oath of office. And then another president, John Tyler, came in, who was immediately stripped of his party affiliation because he had he opposed a number of policy issues that the Whigs had. I believe William Henry Harrison was a Whig and John Tyler was a Whig, but I think he was a Southern Whig, and I think he got stripped. The Whig said, nope, you're not in the party anymore. So he was one of the only presidents since the very early days that served without party, since the 1820s. So it was a mess. But nonetheless, we've always assumed that our president was capable of doing certain things. I think after last night, it became obvious to everyone. And all you got to do is look at the commentaries that are being made, not just by the reliably conservative press. And if I knew what to expect from the conservative press while analyzing this debate. And it's always bugged me a lot when I'd watch something, a speech the president made or something else, and a pundit would come on and tell me what was said. And very often what was said, according to the pundit, was not what the president had said. Why? Because they're trying to steer policy. Well, at this point, even the in the pocket for the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee representatives on places like CNN, MSNBC, the Young Turks, a number of left and far left out pundits are out there saying this was a disaster. And it was a disaster not because, you know, if the president stumbles or he makes misstatements or something, you know, that could be chalked up to nerves or it could be chalked up to just the stress of the moment or whatever. This was not something that could be chalked up merely to nerves or to stress. What is chalked up to is the fact that the president of the United States is mentally incompetent. I don't make that statement lightly. I've thought so all along, and I saw proof in this debate performance last night. He answered questions that weren't asked. We got into some kind of a weird discussion of golf handicaps that were not apropos of anything. Joe Biden went off in this golf handicap thing. And bragged about how he didn't even know what his golf handicap was. He came up with different numbers, 6 and 8 and all that. Well, as someone whose last golf handicap years ago was, I think, a 19, I can say that you have to play a lot of golf to get a handicap of 6. You got to play golf all the time. And you have to have a modicum of talent, which I did not have. And I did not have time to play golf all the time. I would break into a sweat anytime I came to a pond, and sand traps were, my nemesis, and just like a lot of amateur golfers. But the fact is that this discussion on golf handicaps had nothing to do with anything. They were non sequiturs. There was a segment when, Joe Biden was asked a question. Well, let me see if I'm going to try to play it. Listen to this question from CNN and listen to the answer.
President Biden, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this question about the national debt.
He had the largest national debt of any president in a four-year period, number one. Number two, he got $2 trillion tax cut, benefited the very wealthy. What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America, billionaires in America. And what's happening? They're in a situation where they, in fact, pay 8.2% in taxes. If they just paid 24% 25%, either one of those numbers. They'd raise $500 billion, I should say, in a 10-year period. We'd be able to wipe out his debt. We'd be able to help make sure that all those things we need to do, child care, elder care, making sure that we continue to strengthen our health care system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump?
Okay, wow. Now, Trump goes on to say that he was asked to respond, and he said, I don't know what he said at the end, and I don't think he knows what he said at the end, and I don't think he knows what he said at the end. He was struggling, as you heard. But that kind of an answer is so absurd. There are 1,000 trillionaires. Well, he corrected himself. He said billionaires. There are... we're going to do an economics 101 real quick. You can tax and tax and tax and tax the rich. You can, there is no such thing as taxation unto prosperity. You can't do it. Now, is there a minimum tax that needs to be paid? Of course. We need to be able to run the country. Where in the Constitution does the government have the power to control health care? To, by controlling, I mean pay for and therefore dictate all these things that he mentioned, elder care, all these things he wants to be able to do with this this money he's going to get with this one-time tax, tax increase for the quote-unquote rich. And by the way, he made a statement that it only benefited the very wealthy. Well, guess what? I'm not very wealthy, and I benefited from it. And I'm guaranteeing you that you did too. And how did you benefit from it? You actually got a tax break. You actually also, your employer probably got a tax break, which allowed him to hire more people or make improvements in the infrastructure of the business. Some of the things that you don't see. Was there more profit made? Yes, that's the whole theory behind that. That, by the way, we proved work during the Reagan administration, and the left hates it. That is trickle down. It's a terrible name for what happens, because what happens was when you let people keep their own money, they invest it. They may buy stocks. They may invest in their business. There are any number of things that they may do. And that's kind of the whole point of this thing. Joe Biden and the people who are pushing the buttons and pulling the strings in his administration, because he isn't. Obviously, from this debate performance, they are socialists. They operate on the Marxist theory that there's a finite amount of wealth, and that if you just confiscate the wealth that's up at the top, then redistribute it to the bottom, as long as the economic machine is already functioning, it will continue to function. That is an absurd theory. It is the equivalent in physics of a perpetual motion machine. In economics, the idea that somehow you can start the dictatorship of the proletariat, and you'll never have to do anything else. The workers will continue to work, and no further investment will be necessary. That's absurd. That's absurd, because the infrastructure breaks down. When you take away the profit incentive, people stop inventing things. People stop finding ways to be more efficient. All you got to do is look at places where socialism reigns. Yes, in China, they've been very innovative. And how did they do it? They did it by adopting a form of, essentially a kind of a mixed economy, a socialist capitalist economy, which looks a whole lot like Mussolini's Italian fascism. And we've talked about that on this show before. But the fact is that In order for this to work, you cannot tax billionaires into the middle class, because suddenly you destroy your entrepreneur class. That's why in places in the past that have tried this, people who had money, the entrepreneur class, just simply packed up and went someplace else. Sweden tried that. Sweden at one point, way back, when they attempted to adopt a socialist economy, which, by the way, they're attempting to abandon right now. I watched an interview with John Stossel and an economist from Sweden. He asked him about the socialist economy. He goes, "Oh, we're running away. We're not walking away. We're running away as quickly as we can." He says, "We still have some socialist programs." But the fact is, we realize that it was a complete mistake. It almost destroyed our economy. Okay. Does the current president of the United States understand that? Clearly not. What was he promising there? He was promising bread and circuses. Okay. So, like I said before, was this a coup d'etat? Yes. And will we have another debate? I don't think so, unless. And what this debate did was it finally got people on the left side of the fence to start talking seriously about replacing Joe Biden as the candidate for president. But not only that. Now, I'm trying to find a copy of it. I heard a quote from an internal memo after this debate that talked about the fact that, well, this was terrible. He can't do the job. But there's nothing we can do. Well, of course there's something they can do. Now, I'm going to talk about this. First of all, can they replace Joe Biden? Yes, they can. Of course they can. They can replace him as the candidate for president, even though he won all the primaries and won all the delegates. Who can replace him at the convention? Who has the power to decide whether he should be the nominee or not? Well, the answer is easy. It's the delegates. The delegates, even though they're pledged to the president of the United States, if it becomes clear that the president is incompetent and unable to perform the job, the delegates not only have the power, but the duty to make sure that he is not the candidate. Now, people say, well, there's laws, and you have to vote your pledge, and okay. Try and prosecute someone who did not vote for Joe Biden to be the candidate of the Democratic Party when it has become clear that he cannot win the election, at least not by any fair means. Mike O'Reilly, on Talk of the Town, very often he and I discuss this. Mike and I have talked about this back and forth. I've said all along that I don't think Biden will be the candidate. And he said all along, it doesn't matter, they'll steal it. Well, neither one of us, those are not mutually exclusive things. And Mike's concerned that they will simply do what they did in 2020, which is stuff ballot boxes with mimeographed votes for where the only people voted for were Biden and Harris. That's entirely possible, although who will be the candidate? One of the things, if you'll remember, in Ohio that we've run into is that the Democratic convention is so late. It's past the ballot deadline for Ohio. Ohio has a ballot. The ballots have to be, the candidates have to be set, and the Ohio Secretary of State has to be notified that that's who the candidate is, so they can prepare the ballots and get everything set up for. And there's a drop dead date, and it's in August, and the Democratic National Convention is not until 2 weeks after this. So that basically, what was getting ready to be done was that the Democratic Party was going to hold an executive committee vote. I'm not absolutely sure on this. Hold an executive committee vote where they basically deem that because Joe Biden has all the delegates, and more than enough delegates to be nominated, that he is the designated nominee. And that's enough to get him to fix the ballot problem. Now, there were all kinds of things. There were going to be suits filed and all that. But the fact is that the Constitution is clear that the states are in control of their own balloting procedures. Now, could the federal government step in? Oh, they could usurp power and step in and take over, and they would really like to do that, even though it's absolutely and positively unconstitutional. But the fact is that what probably will happen at the debate or at the convention, if President Biden has not withdrawn, and believe me, today I will tell you, you may not hear about it and you may hear about it. There are people from all walks of Democratic life, Democratic Party life, who are petitioning the president, trying to get through to his advisors, trying to get Jill Biden to sit down and be quiet. And she's an important player in here, and I'll explain why. Sit down and be quiet and have him withdraw from his candidacy and this is going to be an interesting thing to see, either free his delegates or to designate his delegates to some other candidate. Now, why do I say that Jill Biden, they want her, why she's an important player and why she needs to sit down and be quiet? She's the one propping him up. And this is completely not without precedent. I can tell you that this has happened in our past. Is Jill Biden the de facto president? No, she's not. Basically the policymakers, the unelected bureaucrats that work for him are the acting president. However, Jill Biden's an important part of this. After World War I, the president was Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson was named, had married, I believe during his term, he married a woman named Edith Galt, and she became Edith Wilson. And she became his wife. And, you know, Wilson was very heavily involved in, after the United States got into World War I. And remember, we didn't declare war until April of 1917, and we weren't actually sending troops and getting troops into the field until early 1918. So the war ended in November of 1918. So here we are in the early months of 1918. And Woodrow Wilson is viewed as something of a messianic figure in Europe. He did a tour in Europe and was lauded as the savior of Europe, you know, coming over, and he had put out these 14 points. And one of the 14 points, the main one that we're going to talk about, is the League of Nations. His big dream, the only reason he really got involved in World War I, had to do with that he wanted to shove through his League of Nations, which essentially was a UN type, you know, international governing body. And he was going to get that passed, and global governance was what Woodrow wanted. After the war ended, after the Germans signed the armistice, remember, they didn't surrender, they signed an armistice, and that's a whole nother discussion. All an armistice does is end the fighting. And then they went through the treaty negotiations, which Wilson was heavily involved in. And remember, they imposed the treaty on Germany, which caused trouble later on. You know, here we go later in the 30s and 40s. What do we get? We get Germany and that whole mess in Europe again, because the problem really wasn't solved and the League of Nations could not have solved it because of the way things were done at the Treaty of Versailles. Okay, so Woodrow Wilson comes home and he begins to campaign here for the passage of the whole package is the League of Nations, and it's before the Senate for ratification. It's part of a treaty. And so what happens? Wilson goes back and forth and back and forth and back, and he works and works and works and works. And there's a lot of opposition. Nobody wants to turn any sovereignty over to this League of Nations body. And that's exactly what they were being asked to do. Even some of the globalists in the Senate, and don't kid yourself, there were a number of them even back in 1919. They were uneasy because their constituents said, no, 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 no. Okay, so Wilson's going back and forth and campaigning and, you know, really putting his whole heart and soul and self into the thing. And what happens to him? He has a stroke. And I mean, not a little tiny one, you know, where he loses a little bit of his speech. He is paralyzed and has to be taken back to the White House. And he lays in bed virtually for the rest of his term. And what happens? His wife, Edith Wilson, essentially becomes the de facto president. Now, is there some of that going on with Jill? Yes, there is. Edith Wilson was doing things like to the point of Woodrow Wilson couldn't sign his name to bills, and she would take his hand in her hand with a pen in it and do his signature on these bills that both of them wanted passed. Now, did they get their League of Nations? No, they didn't. The Senate said, nope, we're not doing that. Wilson never fully recovered, and he was, in some cases, non-compos mentis, means unable to perform the duty. So Edith Wilson did the job. I mean, he did not completely lose the power of speech, but he was not really able to continue to do the work that he needed to be able to do. And what should have happened? He should have been removed from office. Here's the problem. And Edith Galt, or Edith Wilson, should have never been allowed. She controlled who got to see Wilson, because she knew that if other people saw Wilson, they would realize that she's the real power. There were people who did have Wilson's ear, and because Edith Wilson let them be there. And she let them be there precisely because she knew that they wouldn't blow the whistle. So even though the president disappeared for the last year and a half of his term, Edith Wilson was the de facto president, and Jill Biden is trying to use that precedent and prop him up. You know, she, of course, was convinced that he'd won the debate, or she made it look like she was convinced. No one really thought that he won the debate. Gavin Newsom came out and said, Biden won the debate on substance. Well, of course, that's nonsense. Why did Gavin Newsom do that? Well, we'll get into that in a minute. Okay, is there a method now? There wasn't in 1919. Is there a method now for removal of a president due to serious problems, the inability to continue to do the job? And the answer is yes. And I'm going to read this to you and see if any of this makes any sense. This is the 25th Amendment. Section 1, in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. Okay, we already knew that. That's the whole reason why you have a vice president, and that's why So all they did was reiterate that authority of the vice president to step in and take the job, it has not been abrogated in any way. It's still intact. They just simply reiterated it because this is changing a significant portion of the Constitution. Okay, Section 2. Whenever there is a vacancy in the office of the vice president, the president shall nominate a vice president who shall take the office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. Okay, have we ever used this? And the answer is, you bet we have. In 1972 or 3, and we know Nixon resigned in August of 1973, but before that, who was his vice president? His vice president was a guy named Spiro T. Agnew, who had been a governor of Maryland. All right. Spiro Agnew was kind of a spark plug, and you know, he was the left hated him, and he was a lightning rod a little bit, but he lasted. Nixon Agnew in 68 and again in 72. And they won by a landslide in 72. They won by a small margin in 68, but they won by a landslide in 72. Okay. Well, what happens? Suddenly, very mysteriously, and honestly, I think, pardon my paranoia on this, I think this was a bit of a coup. Spiro Agnew finds himself in IRS trouble. And he rushed off the tax court, found guilty. They may have claimed corruption. It's been a long time since I looked into this. But Spiro Agnew, very mysteriously, nobody saw it before this time, but all of a sudden, here he is. He's rushed out of office. Well, what does that mean? That means there has to be a new vice president, according to the 25th Amendment. So the president nominates, and this is where the 25th Amendment is completely off the mark. The president nominates a vice president. Remember that vice presidents, yeah, they're nominated by the president in convention and have been since the 12th Amendment, way, 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 way back in the early 19th century. But the convention picks the vice president. I can't think of a case where the convention has not picked the candidate that the president picked, but nonetheless, the convention actually picks the president. Okay, so in Section 2, we find out that the vice president is nominated by the president, who shall take the office upon confirmation by a majority vote of both houses of Congress. Okay, who did Nixon pick after Agnew resigned? And does anyone remember? You should. It is a famous name. It's Gerald R. Ford. And Gerald R. Ford became the vice president of the United States. And when President Nixon resigned in August of 1973, it was Gerald R. Ford, not Spiro T. Agnew. Gerald R. Ford became the president of the United States. Now, what does that mean? We didn't have a vice president. So what did Gerald R. Ford do? He chose a vice president. And who did he choose? Well, a lot of us conspiracy theory types had a field day here. He chose Nelson Rockefeller, who had been a governor of New York. He became the vice president. So what situation did we find ourselves in? For the first time and only time so far in history, we had both a president and a vice president who had never been voted for by a single voter or a single elector. Now remember, when you cast your presidential vote, you do not cast your vote for the actual candidate. You cast it for an elector. In the same way that when you cast your vote in a primary election for a presidential candidate, you don't vote for the candidate. You vote for a slate of delegates. Okay, we had, for the first time in our history, and hopefully the only time in our history, we had an unelected president and an unelected vice president. Okay, frankly, that was a bit of a coup d'etat, but it was based at least on constitutional procedure. But it's a dangerous place to be. All right, Section 3. This is the meat. Whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the president pro tempore of the Senate is the long... Now, Barry and I got into this years ago. President pro tempore is the de facto head of, or the de jure head of the, not necessarily the de facto head, the de jure head of the Senate. He is the longest, highest seniority member of the party out of power. Okay? So let's say the president is Republican. The president pro tempore of the Senate is the longest serving member from the opposite party, so it would be the Democrats. All right. Whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president as acting president. So, in other words, the president doesn't resign. He becomes his vice president becomes the acting president. So he's still the president. He just can't do the job. And therefore, the VP does the job. Section 4, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments, so cabinet members, or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president. So in other words, if members of the cabinet, of his cabinet, the vice president, a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law provide. Who might do that? They could appoint a presidential commission to examine a sitting president and decide whether or not he is capable of doing the office. So, if the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers, any of the cabinet members, or some other body, then they would essentially place the sitting president into a corner and say, "We're sorry, you can't do the job. We have to have the vice president be the acting president." Meaning all rights, responsibilities, and duties actually stripped from the president. Can anyone see where this might be a serious problem? It could be, but it also could be the way that the Democrats have out of this mess. Because if the elected president of the United States is set aside and an acting president is put in office, that would be Kamala Harris. Can he be the president? Can he be the candidate for president in the November election? Now, there's no legal recourse. There's no, I shouldn't say recourse. There's no legal requirement that he not be the candidate. But why would a convention elect a president who has been removed from actively performing the duty and given the duty to someone else? Why would they nominate him for president? Now, let's say they do nominate him for president, and none of this takes place until the presidential candidates. Let's just say it's in late August they nominate him, Biden, for president, the presidential candidate, and he has a complete breakdown and has to be removed. What then? Who gets to decide? The convention's over. Who gets to decide who's the presidential candidate? Well, probably, and having been involved in party politics, I think their only choice at that point is to have the party executive committee make that decision, which is why I think that you will see a move to get Biden to step aside, to write that letter, to step aside from being the active president of the United States and putting and swearing in Kamala. I know she doesn't like Kamala. I don't want to be insulting Kamala Harris. She would become the acting president. Now, does that mean automatically she becomes the presidential candidate? Well, the answer to that is absolutely not. No, she does not. That is something that the party has to decide. Now, would they, in the interest of, would she, let's say he is removed from being the active president, and Kamala Harris takes over before the convention. What then? Any number of scenarios. And there's another person who we've talked about and someone we haven't talked about. This is when I wish my late friend, he will be gone a year on July the 2nd, Barry Sheets. He and I used to talk about, go back and forth on this all the time. And I said, I can only think of one scenario where this would happen. Okay, who do I think the Democrats might pick to be the president if Joe Biden has to vacate before the convention? Now remember, this is not, the convention is 2 months away. That's very close for this kind of a mechanism to take place. All right, who do I think? Do I think Kamala Harris would end up being the candidate? I do not. I do not. She's unlikable. She has huge negatives. She's not well-liked in the party. She's hooked up with the wrong political machine. And what do I mean by that? Are there political machines inside the Democratic Party? Yes. Are there political machines hooked up inside the Republican Party? Yes, there are. They both have machines that have active organizations, and they have potential candidates all over the place. Let's talk about, I can think of at least two, maybe three inside the Democratic Party. The first one is, I think two. The first one is the Clinton machine. The McClinton machine is still at work, still has a lot of control in the Democratic National Committee, but they took some hits. And, of course, Bill's out of the picture because Bill himself is kind of non-compass menace these days. He's not in very good shape at all. But Hillary's still there. She knows that she has zero chance of being president, but they have people who they're propping up. And one of those people would be Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. Now, Gavin Newsom would be a nightmare for them because there have been attempts to recall him. He's made major mistakes. California is a pluperfect mess. And, of course, he blames the Republicans for opening the border, and I laugh at that. I'm like, you brought in illegal immigrants. You gave them luxury hotels. You gave them – you ran people out of schools so you could make them into shelters for the homeless. You made sure they got welfare, and you made sure they got driver's licenses. And with driver's licenses, because we have motor voter, a lot of them registered to vote. I have seen this happen. I was in Bureau of Motor Vehicles, and someone who essentially had to have a translator there was asked, are you a citizen? Yes. This man was not a citizen. But so, would you like to register to vote? Yes. Now, do I know for sure he wasn't a citizen? No. But he had just come from Mexico. And look, the guy wasn't a citizen. They asked him to register to vote, and he said yes, and they registered him to vote. No one is checking on this. No one is requiring either to provide a birth certificate or to provide naturalization papers. Under both cases, you could vote. Okay, will Kamala Harris be the candidate? No. She's probably closer to the Clinton machine than, although she's very close with the Obamas. The other machine is the Obama machine. And the Obama machine is who got Biden elected. Now, what does that mean? Newsom's really more associated with that California out there barber boxer and that machine out there. Remember that Barbara Boxer was Hillary Clinton's sister-in-law. Okay. Kamala Harris is unattractive for any number of reasons. Gavin Newsom has problems. So between these two candidates, who would be the most likely? I think Gavin Newsom would be the most likely. But I think it's also unlikely because under the scenario that I told Barry Sheets about, oh gosh, maybe as far back as 20. If you want to, go to our archives at principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And you can listen to some of the shows where we talk about this. And boy, do I miss his analysis. I really want his analysis on this. And of course, he's busy worshiping the Lord in heaven. I really would love to have his expertise back. And I have people who can inform. But who do I think the scenario that could possibly happen, because this is such a weird circumstance, and the party would come to her, this person, and say, we need you. You can unite the country. You can unite the voters. You're the person who can really do the job. And in most cases, I would say not a snowball's chance in the nether regions. But under this circumstance, this is just weird enough to drive the Democratic Party to Michelle Obama as the potential candidate. Now, if you've listened to me on Talk of the Town with Mike O'Reilly, I've said I don't see any scenario where that could really happen. Well, this is a scenario where that could really happen. You draw out the people who voted for Hillary because she was a woman. You get Michelle because she's a woman. On top of, she would be the second black president, but she would be the first female president if they could get her elected. If they if they can manage to get the job done and pull the trigger on Michelle Obama, she would unite the people who are like, she'd get the feminist vote. She would get the racial agitator vote. It's a kind of a no-brainer in this situation. She would get actually the sympathy vote. And what do I mean by that? People feel sorry because Joe Biden had to be removed because of his clear incompetence. She would get that vote. The people who don't vote on issues but vote on emotion, she would get that vote. I have switched my position to thinking that it could be that they will remove Joe Biden, and I'm almost positive they're going to remove Joe Biden, and they're going to replace her with Michelle Obama. Now, I could be wrong on that, and you can feel free to send me emails. My email is chairman@principledpolicy.com. That's chairman@principledpolicy.com. And you can tell me I'm an idiot, tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm here to tell you that it's a very, 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 very possible scenario that Michelle Obama could be the nominee for president. Now, who would be the vice presidential nominee? That would, I'll be quite honest, the perfect choice would be Gavin Newsom. there's a lot of other Democratic players out there, and a lot of them are damaged. But I think Michelle Obama would be the one. So could we use the 25th Amendment? By the way, I want to finish this. We talked about if the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the president as acting president. That's immediately upon the vote, upon notifying Congress, the president pro tem of the Senate, and Speaker of the House. They write the declaration, and the vice president is in charge, period, right then. Now, this section 4 goes on. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the powers and duties of his office unless the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive department or of such body as Congress may by law provide transmit within 4 days to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. In other words, the president can try to take back control of the government, but if the vice president and the cabinet or another body say, no, he's not, then the House and Senate can say, nope, not going to happen. Thereupon, if they write and say the president still can't do the job, thereupon Congress shall decide the issue. So Congress, the elected representatives of the United States of America, doesn't get to really make the decision until the president tries to reestablish control and the vice president and the cabinet or whatever body the by law has been appointed, until they say no. Okay. Can you see a coup d'etat in this kind of setup? This is in the Constitution, though. This is the way it works. All right. Thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours. So if Congress is out of session, they have to come back into session within 48 hours for that purpose, if not in session. If the Congress within 21 days after receipt of the letter, the latter written declaration, that is from the vice president and the cabinet or the legal body, determines if Congress within 21 days after receipt of the latter written declaration, or if Congress is not in session within 21 days after Congress is required to assemble, determines by two-thirds vote of both houses that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall continue to discharge the same as acting president. Otherwise, the president shall resume the powers and duties of his office. At this point, watching the reaction of what has gone on from all sides in Congress, if the vice president and the cabinet came out today and said it's become quite clear that the president cannot execute his duties of the office, Kamala Harris could take power instantly. And if Joe Biden writes a letter to the president pro tem and the speaker and says, no, I'm fine. The Senate and the House have to come back into session. They're in session now, so this is not a big deal. Has to take it up. Make the determination. If now let's say that Joe Biden writes a letter and says, no, I'm fine. Sends it to the president pro tem and the Speaker of the House, then the Kamala Harris and the majority of the cabinet writes another letter back to the president pro tem and the Speaker of the House and says, no, he is not. Then the Congress has to vote on whether to remove him or not. At this point, I don't think there's much question that the sitting House of Representatives and the sitting Senate would vote two-thirds to make Kamala Harris the acting president. When do I see this happening? I see this happening very soon, because let's face it, when's prime time for presidential campaigns? Prime time for presidential campaigns is basically August, September, October. We're almost in July, folks. We have July 4th coming up a week from Thursday. What does that mean? That means they got to get this job done, because the wheels on this kind of thing tend to turn slow. If you see this happening and it goes really fast, you'll know the wheels have been greased by the political elites. They want this to take place. They want Joe Biden to be removed because it's become obvious he can't do the job. Now, what does that do to the upcoming presidential debate? The second presidential debate is scheduled to take place September 10th. That's after the Democratic National Convention. Okay? And the Democratic National Convention is scheduled to take place August 19th through the 24th. Something has to happen between now and then, and I think you will see something happen very, very quickly. Very quickly. It has to happen very quickly. Now, again, if all this falls apart after the convention, then you've got a major electoral issue on your hand. This is why you will see the CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, NPR, MSNBC, name it. You will start to hear discussion of the president has to step aside. The president has to step aside. It started happening last night already. If you're paying attention, it started already. They're already talking about the fact that Joe Biden needs to step aside. And he does. He really does. For the good of the country. Not necessarily for the good of the Trump campaign. Frankly, right now, I'm not sure that anybody can beat Trump. Although, in the scenario I just laid out to you, Michelle Obama might be able to pull it off. Maybe. Okay, that's not completely where I wanted to go. But look for the things I just described to happen. Look for calls for the Biden to step aside to get more and more and more potent. Look for big leaders in the parties to go to the president, tell him he has to step aside, and they might be able to get it done. Okay, you know what I think. I want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And my email is chairman@principledpolicy.com. I would ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.